Welcome and thank you for being here. And now on to a little bit of business. If everyone can make sure their cell phone is turned off, I understand there's no reception down here, but that doesn't mean your alarm won't go off or something might happen. So please check that now. And you should have had the opportunity to get a question card when you walked in if you have not already submitted your question online. Many of you submitted a question when you RSVP'd for tonight's forum. Those questions have all been sorted by category. Do they pertain to parks and open space, or walkability, or urban forestry? And our moderator for this evening has received all of those questions. If by chance we don't make it to your question this evening, all of the questions will be attached to the notes that are being taken tonight and given to all of the candidates and posted on all the partner organizations' websites so that you know that your question will be seen and considered by the folks asking for your vote. And now I just want to do a brief agenda review, which also has the rules of engagement printed right on it so you can follow how tonight's forum is going to work. We're dividing our conversation into three parts with 20 minutes or so for each section of the forum. The first one will be on pedestrian safety and walkability, the second on parks and open space, and then the third on urban forestry issues. The rules of engagement are intended to keep this a lively and dynamic discussion, illustrate policy differences between the candidates. It's not very useful to have a live questionnaire where every candidate answers every question because a lot of us have already issued questionnaires to the candidates and we wanted tonight's conversation to be a little bit more dynamic. So our moderator will decide if candidates have 1 to 2 minutes for each question, depending on the juicy nature of the question. Not all candidates will be asked to answer each question, and questions in the amount of time that each candidate is given are at the discretion of our able moderator. And then each candidate has, Phil, can you hold yours up, a bonus minute to use at any time throughout the debate if there's something they really want to respond to and they weren't called upon to answer. And then we will finish with some closing remarks. And so that is going to be the flow for this evening's presentation. And again, it's on the front of your agenda. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our moderator for this evening's forum. He is an urban design critic and writes for the San Francisco Chronicle and has been a really fun partner in getting ready for this forum with. I'd like to introduce Mr. John King.
Thank you, and I want to emphasize the fact these will all be on the website that Meredith mentioned, because there are a number of good questions that will not be asked tonight, but they are there and they are out there. And there's going to be a fluid number of candidates. We were supposed to be starting with 8. I actually see 6, which makes it better, but they'll be coming and going as the evening goes. One has already come and gone. That was City Attorney Dennis Herrera, who was kind of juggling events tonight. I want to start, in lieu of an opening statement, which the candidates have very graciously agreed not to present, I'm going to read just short biographies of everyone who's here that I made up as I was rushing over here. Not the facts, just the selection of the facts. And then I will begin asking some questions about parks and open space. And as Meredith said, this will be a pretty fluid questioning format. So I'm going to be kind of stumbling along. The candidates, again, have been gracious enough to let us kind of play around with something other than a march of questions up and down. So I'm going to start just with the bios working from one end to the other. The first candidate here tonight is Michaela Alioto-Peer. She served on the Board of Supervisors from 2004 until 2010. She is 43 and comes from an extremely well-known San Francisco political family, including a former mayor and a former mayoral candidate. She worked in Vice President Al Gore's policy office at the White House, and in 1998 was the Democratic candidate for California Secretary of State. Her website says that Alioto-Peer entered the campaign because, quote, "I want my children to find the same opportunities for education, careers, and community that 5 generations of my family have found in San Francisco." Sitting next to her is Jeff Adachi. He is San Francisco's public defender, a post to which he was elected in 2002. He is 52 and was born in Sacramento. 42. Am I off by 10 years?
No.
Thank you.
Oh, I said, okay. Oh.
Wow.
Heckling from the front. This is now I know why they do the opening statements. He is 52, according to what I read, and was born in Sacramento, received a law degree from UC Hastings in 1985, and joined the Public Defender's Office in 1986. While the late entrance into the mayoral campaign of another candidate was followed widespread speculation, Public Defender Adachi's last-minute entrance came as a surprise, since he is known primarily to the general public, besides his elected post, for his emphasis on the need for pension reform, which played out in one ballot initiative and now a second that will be on the fall ballot. Next, we have Terry Joan Baum. Terry Joan Baum is the Green Party candidate for mayor. She moved to San Francisco in 1977 after moving up to the Bay Area from Southern California a few years earlier, and she joined the Green Party in 2003, running for Congress against Nancy Pelosi the following year. Baum describes herself on her campaign website as a pioneer lesbian playwright and says that, and I chose this quote for this crowd, "It's time to reject the realism that has led our city to kowtow to corporations, such as the Twitter tax break, at the same time it creates a new fee for the Arboretum in Golden Gate Park." Next up is Tony Hall, and he is a former supervisor who has worked in a variety of city agencies, most recently at the Treasure Island Development Corporation, but also he spent time in the budget analyst office for the Board of Supervisors. He is 69 and was born in Los Angeles, moving here in his 20s. His campaign website promises common sense solutions to tough issues and says that in the past 6 years, "I have watched San Francisco turning in the wrong direction as special interests and insider agendas have put politics over people." Next up is Joanna Rees. Is it Rees?
Rees.
Okay, I've got it right. She is the founder of VSP Capital, a venture capital firm. Rees is 49 and was born in New Jersey, moving here in her early 1930s with two children and opening a restaurant. Well, here she then discovered all sorts of elixirs, and then, anyway. Well, okay, she moved here in her early 30s with two children who were not in their early 30s and opened a restaurant before starting the firm. An adjunct professor at Santa Clara University, Rees is one of the few candidates with no electoral experience, promising on her campaign website that she'll draw on her private time focusing on practical ideas where the cutting edge meets common sense. "I'm a progressive independent. I'm not part of the City Hall crowd." And last, we have Phil Ting. Phil is the city's assessor recorder, a post he was appointed to by Mayor Gavin Newsom in 2005 and subsequently won in his own right since. He is 42 and grew up in Southern California, earning degrees from UC Berkeley and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He emphasizes muni reform in his campaign, which he bills as ResetSanFrancisco.org, which, to quote the website, is all about ending the bickering at City Hall by empowering every resident, not just insiders. And then also, supposedly on the way, but he had a prior engagement for part of it, is Board of Supervisor President David Chu, who is 41 and moved to San Francisco from the Boston area where he attended Harvard. He worked as both a prosecutor and a civil rights attorney before founding Grassroots Enterprise. Okay, and so the way we will work, we've got six candidates. So I will start by asking a question to three and then a question to another three with, let's have 2 minutes each on the answers, and there is a staffer here who's going to be flashing signs, but they're old veterans at this by now. They've done four forums already today and have more lined up. So the first question, and I think I will ask it of Terry Jo Baum, Joanna Rees, and Phil Ting, in that order. What do you, and I should mention that these are paraphrases of the questions that were submitted by all of you and by other members, and just for size, length, so on and so forth. What would you consider are the determining factors in closing a street to cars and making it exclusively a pedestrian street? Would you be open to testing more street closures to cars? In short, are there streets besides Market Street that we should consider making off limits to private automobiles? And first, Terry Joan Baum.
Yes, I do think that this would be a wonderful idea. It's a way to revitalize a neighborhood, and people are so drawn to places without cars. There's just no doubt about it. But I think, I know that this idea was put forward in Noe Valley, one of the blocks right off 24th Street, and it did not bring in enough dialogue with the neighbors before it was put forward. And there was not any real idea of how the neighbors, the people who lived on that block that was suggested to be closed off, were going to deal with it. And therefore, there was this incredible resistance and this incredible campaign. So I think it demands a lot more discussion with the people whose access is going to be on a street without cars before we get to actually closing it off. However, I am all for as much acreage without cars as possible. I really believe we need transit so great you don't need your car, and we should be working towards buses every 10 minutes from 6 a.m. to midnight, and bike paths very safe all over the city, so that we can, in fact, suggest that people leave their cars home almost all the time, and we can then easily create more streets that are car-free and people and bike-friendly.
Joanna Rees, would you also look at what are the factors determining street closures, and then would you consider streets beyond Market Street for closing?
I would be open to having street closures and others in multiple streets here in San Francisco. I think we have to look at it in two ways. One, the one thing that I would love to see us start to embrace as a city is more of an entrepreneurial spirit, where we're continually testing and innovating and trying to figure out ways to improve things. So I think it's important that before even implementing something like that, that we test it on different streets and for different areas. And then I think on the other side, we have to make sure that we do a better job of getting community input. I spent 2 years going neighborhood by neighborhood before I decided to run, and I say I discovered the silent, rational majority. So many people just feel like their voice isn't heard, and they don't have an outlet to speak about about issues that impact their neighborhood or their community. So if we're going to go do that, it's really important that we get neighborhood engagement, so there's neighborhood support, and that we also put in place a program of making sure that we test to see what the impact would be, and we explore even maybe trying it even in a temporary basis where we close streets for evenings. I know on 24th Street they do in the Mission it's Fridays or Thursdays, it's a night festival where they close off the street, and then there's much more foot traffic, and I think we have to encourage more of that.
Okay, great. And Phil Ting.
Well, I think it's a great idea to look at this issue. I'm a father of two very, very young children, one who's 1 year old, who just started walking, one that's 4 years old. So for me, I think the number one issue that I would look at is safety. We actually have many streets now in San Francisco where it doesn't feel safe to drive, walk, or bike down them. I think we need to take a serious look at, maybe it's not very smart to have every street be open to three or four modes of transportation. Maybe we should make it more efficient by emphasizing certain nodes and have transit, and having certain nodes where it's just cars, and having certain nodes where we have a lot of walking and biking. I'm a huge supporter and fan of Sunday Streets. I don't know if you were all out yesterday in the Western Edition. It's amazing how the city feels when there aren't cars. I don't fear for the lives of my children. I don't feel like I have to watch them every single second of the time that they're with me. I actually feel like, you know, we could bring out my daughter's tricycle and let her bike around, which is kind of a phenomenal feeling. And I think for anybody who's sort of skeptical, I think all you need to do is just really look at how Hayes Valley, the neighborhood right around the corner, has really been transformed by not having a freeway and by some planning and not having every mode of transportation go through it or dedicating open space or, you know, making sure that we have adequate transit going through that neighborhood. I think also, again, what other plans have emphasized is one, making sure that neighbors and merchants are part of that dialogue. And really that's what we're been focused on with Reset San Francisco, is making sure everybody has a voice, not just the voices who can afford to be at City Hall or people who can afford to take off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to come testify, but really everybody. And so that's why we have a 24/7 community online that we reach out to, talk to face-to-face, and that's really one of the first places we do it. I'd love to post this idea and to pilot it and see, you know, what streets would people want to? Just like we've been talking about, you know, should we really have bus stops, 2 bus stops on a block? Does that really, really make sense?
Great, thanks very much. Now the next question will be for Tony Hall, Michaela Alioto-Peer, and Jeff Adachi. And this is a fairly general one, but of great interest to one of the groups here. What specific steps would you take to increase pedestrian safety in San Francisco, and in particular south of Market? And we'll start with Tony Hall.
Thank you, John, for the question. That's a good one, because when I was on the Board of Supervisors, I made 5 promises and a 6th one that I delivered on excessively, and that was street safety. The first 4 were the restoration of Laguna Honda, Harding Park, the Youth Guidance Center, the Ocean Avenue Business Corridor, which took up a lot of engineering, and the rescue of Lake Merced. But one of the things I was really proud of is we instituted 23 different safety approaches for District 7. And it was fairly simple to do. It wasn't that expensive, believe it or not. It was a matter of getting together with the Department of Public Works and saying, we have a dangerous intersection here, we have a confusing intersection here, we have a crosswalk for children here, a lot of schools and parks out there. So I sat down with them for 2 or 3 months, over a 2 or 3 month period, and with Bonnie, and we went over exactly what was needed. Instead of asking for add-backs in the budget, I just said, this is what I want for my district, and I kept on them and kept on them and kept on them. So it was a matter of leadership and will to get it done. And that's what it takes when you're a mayor or a member of the Board of Supervisors. It takes the tenacity to keep on your departmental resources to make these things happen. Pedestrian safety is not something that it can't be done. It's something that can be very easily acquired, but you have to identify it, you have to go out into the neighborhood, you have to respond to the people that are talking to you, and then it's your job to get it done. I was an executive 35 years in 7 different departments with this city, so I knew exactly how it functioned and how it should be functioning and what to do to get it done. So of that record, I think you have to look at who did what, and so that's just one of the areas that I was very, very proud of.
Right. Thanks very much. The question on what specific steps to increase pedestrian safety in San Francisco, and in particular south of the Market, for Jeff Adachi.
I would identify 3 things. One is deterrence. In criminal justice, deterrence is something that works, provided that it's enforced. And in San Francisco, I don't know if you'd agree with this or not, but it's fairly difficult in the SoMa area to get a moving violation. What you get killed with are parking tickets. They'll kill you with parking tickets, but not moving violations. The second thing would be surveillance cameras, or, you know, the traffic cameras. And I think those have actually been effective in terms of reducing, particularly the drivers that are speeding or they're, you know, making illegal turns, because there's a consequence to that. The third thing is that we have to be more responsive, you know, when our residents say that there's a problem. At the Hall of Justice, believe it or not, for 20 years, there was no traffic light. And so you'd see every day prosecutors, defenders, judges jaywalking across the street, literally running across the street. And it was finally a court reporter who decided to do something about it. And it took her 7 years, her name was Cynthia Markopoulos, to get a traffic light put there, and now it's there, and people use it. So I know that's just one example, but I do think that we have to look at the problem areas, and they're very easy to identify, because they're where people get hurt, where people get hit by vehicles, and where there are a lot of accidents. So those are the three things that I would do.
Great, thanks very much. And Michaela Alioto Pier, and Supervisor John Avalos is coming in. I'll introduce him in just a second. But Michaela Alioto Pier, what specific steps would you take to increase pedestrian safety in San Francisco, in particular South of Market?
Thank you, John. I'm going to personalize this story. I've had a number of elderly people actually ask me this question, and I think that if you use or have ever used a wheelchair, or if you've ever pushed a baby stroller, especially South of Market, you realize how hard it is. And there is a part of me that would love to put every member of DPT in a chair for the day and take them around San Francisco. Because the landscape of the city is not particularly friendly to people who have a tough time getting around. But it also means that it's not that easy for anybody. And when you go south of Market, it is extremely difficult to cross a street when you have any type of wheel mode, because of the amount of potholes and because of the time that it takes to get from one end to the other. And so first, I think what we really need to do is we need to look at our crosswalks in SoMa. We need to make sure that we have curb cuts that are smooth, that you don't have a lot of little steps, and not just for me, but anybody, because you're crossing the street and you trip over it. You trip over the potholes, and we need more timed lights. That is something that has always gone over very, very well. I think that it is the goal of DPT to have them throughout the city. But ensuring that we have enough time for people to cross the street is extremely important, especially in areas where the cars are moving very quickly and they're not paying much attention. And when you're in the South of Market area, we have a lot of on-roads and off-roads onto our freeway system. The other thing that I will also say is that I had one experience where I was crossing the street with my six-year-old holding her hand, and a guy got up, ran into the intersection, kicked me in the behind. I started losing my balance. I grabbed Gigi in the middle of the street, and I got to the side and turned around. And at some point, too, and I think that this is a little bit of what Jeff was talking about, but we have to have some kind of accountability to make sure that people are able to walk in a safe way, that we're protected, and that not only the physical structure is accommodating, but that the environment is safe.
Great, thank you. And we were just joined, again, I told you this was going to be fluid with folks coming and going during the evening. We were just joined by Supervisor John Avalos. He is a first-term member of the Board of Supervisors and former legislative aide to Supervisor Chris Daley. Avalos is 46 and was born in Los Angeles, moving here to attend San Francisco State University, where he mastered in social work, and then became a labor organizer. His campaign website describes him as an effective legislator with firm principles and values, a strong work ethic, and a collaborative and unifying approach to getting the city's work done. I kind of crunched every candidate. And I didn't get any of your facts wrong, so no laughter from the audience on this one. So I'm going to put you into the next roll of questions. But I want to now switch to a question that I will also ask just for a few people. And this is, again, a bit general, and then we'll get to some specifics, but the question is, what neighborhood do you feel is most emblematic of the perfect pedestrian-focused environment in San Francisco? Conversely, is there a neighborhood that should be at the top of the next mayor's to-do list with regards to pedestrian comfort and safety? And that'll be 2 minutes, and we'll start with Joanna Rees, and then John Avalos, and then Michaela Alioto Pier.
That's a tough foot on the neighborhood that is the most supportive for pedestrians, but there's several. I always think of the downtown area because there's so many great wide walkways, and it just, so whether it's North Beach or the Barbary Coast, Golden Gateway area, just in terms of being able to walk around and access different resources, those areas, and also access outdoor space. I think those areas are very pedestrian friendly. Today I did a merchant walk in Visitation Valley, and I'll tell you, it is not pedestrian friendly. I can't tell you how many merchants said to me in several areas. First of all, there's so many streets that had no stop signs, and I heard about numerous people being hit, where the merchants told me that they've complained to the city, that they called 311 and filed complaints, and nothing's been done. That there are streets with absolutely no stop signs and people step off the curb and it's quite dangerous. Those areas too, the sidewalks, I'll tell you today, there is a disparity in San Francisco. Those sidewalks were in incredible disrepair. The street was too, it was filthy. I was embarrassed to say this was part of San Francisco. The streets were filthy, dirty. And the merchants tell me they try to clean up and clean outside of their stores, but it was not a friendly place for pedestrians. And then lastly, there were a lot of issues around public safety. I heard from many, many merchants just in terms of walking around that area, so many issues with people with knives and guns. And again, they're calling the police department, but there's not enough foot patrol traffic in the area, and it really makes it uncomfortable for people to be out and about.
Okay, great, thanks very much. And the question of basically neighborhood that's most pedestrian friendly and neighborhood that needs a lot of work for Supervisor Avalos.
Great, thank you very much, and sorry I'm late. It's really great to be here. I hope you didn't get the information about my age from my own website. If so, I have to update it because I'm 47 years old.
Oh,
six.
But complaining about it.
Maybe that was my website.
That's an honest politician.
You heard it, not from me. So, you know, I go down Valencia Street very often on my bicycle, and I am very jealous of what I see on Valencia Street. I know it took years in the making to be able to create a pedestrian-friendly street on Valencia. That is not the norm in San Francisco. We have a streetscape that is really amazing. It offers a wider space for pedestrians to walk on. It offers wider space for tables and cafes. There is actually crosswalks with curb cuts that are really well done. You have a bike lane right there. You have less distance to actually cross the street, so it's safer to cross in the street. And to achieve that, we had to get a lot of funding from the federal government. That is not what we expect to see. It's what we should expect to see in neighborhoods all across San Francisco, and unfortunately it's not. And the most emblematic, and probably one of the most dangerous neighborhoods is the South of Market neighborhood, which you've already touched upon here. 19th Avenue, South of Market. I'll talk about South of Market. We have one-way streets where cars zoom by very, very quickly. We have a very wide distance to cross. There are not medians in the middle of the street for pedestrians to seek safety on. We need to figure out how to find ways to create those spaces. I believe actually looking at moving from one-way streets to two-way streets can help to slow down traffic and make a huge difference in the experience that pedestrians have. There's a lot more infrastructure we need to be able to put in our streetscapes, wider sidewalks, less distance to cross the street, bulb outs for our muni buses, those are some of the essential features I'd like to be able to see put in there in the South of Market. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks a lot. And then the final question on best and needs fixing neighborhood for Michaela Alioto-Pierre, who's already talked about South of Market eloquently.
Thank you. Thanks, John. I was lucky enough to represent District 2 for 7 years, which is the Marina, Cow Hollow, Pacific Heights, Presidio Heights, Seacliff, Jordan Park, and Russian Hill. And I'd have to say that we have some very, very beautiful walkable space in that neighborhood. We have Crissy Field, which is fabulous. We've got the Marina Greens. We have a Bay Trail that, unfortunately, I was unable to get completed, but that would be one of my priorities as mayor, to complete the Bay Trail and fix it, especially along the Marina Greens, connecting it back to Crissy Field in a prettier way. But that whole walk across the water and then over the hill and into the wharf area, I think, is really something special. But there are a lot of special walkable places in San Francisco, and I think that that's one of the reasons that we're the city that we are. And the fact that we're a walkable place with all of our hills, I think, is a testament to our health and our stamina, but also our adventureness. But I'd also agree with, actually, I would agree with both John and with Joanna. The Bayview is not a walkable place, although Joanna said Visitation Valley. I'm more focused on the Bayview for a number of different reasons: the quality of the streets, the speed of the traffic, and Soma. Soma is just one of those places that should just be, it should be so easy with all the stores and with the opportunities that we have in that neighborhood. It should be a much more walkable place, and it isn't.
Great. Thanks so much. Joanna Reese has to take off early, so if you want to slip out, I don't know how your time is working out, but if you want to slip out in the next minute or two, there's an opening.
Okay.
So she will need to leave. What I want to do now is ask questions of candidates, and these will just be one-minute questions, much shorter, but they're also much more focused on the topic. So I'm going to start with a question on a walkability issue that is not the type of thing you see south of Market so much, but very much what you see in a number of the city's western neighborhoods. And that is, there are a number of cars, you know, thousands of cars parked on the sidewalks of San Francisco are parked in what used to be front lawns and, you know, have been turned over into paving and into the front, into the sidewalks. This is an untenable situation for the questioner. And the questioner says, what are you going to do to get and keep cars off the sidewalks? And I want to give this, again, this is just 1 minute, and I'm just going to give it to two people. First to Phil Ting, then to Tony Hall. So, Phil.
Great. Well, it's a perfect question for me because I live in the Sunset. I think what we need to do is, as a city and as, you know, working with groups like FOF, is to make sure we're incentivizing people to, one, not pave over their front yards. I mean, it's so amazing to me. People are so afraid of the upkeep, the eyesore, so they say, hey, it's just so much easier, let me just pave it over. I don't really think parking is the main issue, because I think we actually have much more parking on the west side of town than we do on many of the eastern neighborhoods. I think another thing is, you all heard about some of the horror stories around trees, where, you know, neighbors in the city start citing people to upkeep trees and start maintaining trees, and that actually starts fining people significantly. And I think we need to have a happy medium so that people don't fear having a tree in their front yard. I mean, for me, I know one of the things that I was very happy with is our last one, we had a nice front lawn, and nice to have kind of a green area in front of our home today. But so many of the neighbors that I talked to, they're so afraid of moving that direction because they're afraid of the upkeep costs, the maintenance costs, and also the city finding them. So I think we need to make sure that we get the message out properly.
Great. Thanks so much. And Tony Hall.
Thank you, John. I agree with Phil there. It's unfortunate, but it does happen that people will pave over their lawn area to park their car. That's the price you have to pay to live in San Francisco. I'm not one to tell people what to do with their property unless it's a danger to others. In 2002, I think it was November of 2002, I actually introduced legislation that said they cannot block, people cannot use their cars to block the sidewalk. And I believe it really wound up at Donnybrook at the board, because the police department weighed in and said, well, there's a problem here with people blocking their driveways. And I fought that to keep the legislation pure. I don't care if they're blocking their own driveway. I do care if they're blocking the sidewalk. So we got that passed for handicap reasons and for people who want to walk down the sidewalk. It's a common sense law. It's in existence today. Whether it's being enforced by this administration or not, I doubt. But anyway, it is a law that's on the books that says you cannot block the sidewalk. And that's it. So it has to be enforced.
Great. And before she leaves, Joanna Reese is exercising her priority.
So this goes back to the disparities. There is a disparity in enforcement on this issue. I've done 25 neighborhood talks. And I will tell you, in certain neighborhoods, people complain because their car is in their driveway, maybe out in the into the sidewalk a tiny bit, and they get a very expensive ticket. And then today, going back to Visitation Valley, I cannot tell you how many people came up to me on the street and said, my neighbors park on the sidewalk. In fact, tried. They've called again to have something done, and nothing's done. We have to get rid of this disparity in San Francisco and make sure that we are serving all. If there's a law on the books, it has to be enforced in all neighborhoods, not just in selective ones. And I can tell you, you can go around the city and you will see this. And it's unfortunate, and as a leader, it needs to be enforced.
Thanks so much. And now I have two more questions, and then we'll move from pedestrian safety to parks and open space. And the first question is, I want, and these will be minute answers, fairly short, I want to know if the mayoral candidates would consider licensing bicycles, requiring cyclists to stop at red lights and stop signs and yield the right of way to pedestrians. The money from bike licenses could be used to make more bike lanes to keep bikers and pedestrians safer. And again, 1 minute answer, and this will go first to Jeff Adachi and then to Michaela Alioto-Pierre.
You know, I'd definitely be open to this. I haven't, you know, studied, you know, what the impact of this would be. We certainly would want to do it in a way that would reduce or discourage people from riding bikes. And, you know, if people weren't able to afford a license, if people weren't able to register their bikes, I mean, there is that potential. And if that was the case, I certainly, you know, would reconsider. I mean, the advantage of making sure that bicycles are following the rules of the road is that you're going to, I think, have a clear understanding by everyone, including motorists, pedestrians, and bike riders, what the rules are. And certainly, I've seen a number of instances where either people weren't following the rules or everyone had their own set of rules as you're interacting with each other. So I, you know, would be open to this. However, I'd want to look at the impact, particularly how it might affect people who do not have the resources to pay the licensing fee.
Thanks. And Michaela Alioto-Pierre.
License
bicycles.
Thank you, John. Yes, I would. Bicyclists now, unless you're 10, you're supposed to be riding on the street along with the cars. And because of that, we do need to have more uniformity so that people know that when they're stepping off the curb, they're not going to get hit if the light is green. And so, yes, I would.
Great. Thanks so much. And the last question, again, 1 minute each. Oh, sure. Terrific. Hop in.
Okay. Yes, I am for licensing bicycles and for bikes obeying the law. I think most people who have a bike could afford $35 for a license. But what we really need are safe, dedicated bike paths, a network all over the city. And in terms of safe, I mean that there's a physical barrier between the car traffic and the bike traffic. This is what they have in many cities in Europe, such as Amsterdam and Berlin, so that people can safely ride it. Now is not safe to ride a bicycle in San Francisco, and I think that is what that licensing money should be used for, and also we need to devote really considerable funds to this issue so that we can stop the bike accidents and more people can feel free to ride their bicycles all over the city.
Great, thanks. And now we'll move to the final question of this section, which is for Terry Joan Baum and John Avalos. And this is kind of the polar opposite of the licensing bicycles. And this question is the idea of taxing households with more than two cars an option to raise money for various park and open space programs? First to John Avalos.
Well, I actually support a local vehicle license fee. I think a lot of the candidates here have talked about a local vehicle license fee. We have a small one. We are awaiting California state legislation to enable us to have a more robust vehicle license fee. To me, having such a fee would allow us to be able to put greater revenue towards transit, towards pedestrian safety, towards bicycle infrastructure. In 2003, we had a statewide vehicle license fee, a portion that was cut dramatically by the governor at the time, or the new governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so we could actually recover a great deal amount at the local level to do more local work towards building our infrastructure and supporting pedestrian safety efforts and bicycle infrastructure.
Great, thanks so much. Okay, that is going to close the section on pedestrian safety. I was distracted looking at the next questions. And Terry Joan Baum, my apologies.
I totally agree with John. It's not easy to pass taxes now, and we have to be able to have a state law that allows us to create our own taxes, and we must use that money to create a transit system so that people can leave their cars at home. This is not yet what we have. We can't expect people to rely on something that's not reliable. That's why people get cars, because they feel they can't rely on Muni. We need to put that money so that we have a truly reliable, frequent, comfortable, and ultimately magnificent transit system. I believe that we need mosaics and murals in all the underground stations, and all the bus shelters should also be works of art. Let's put our artists to work to make our transit system beautiful.
Thanks very much. And the next section is on parks and open space. And since we're now we're now at six, so what I'm gonna do, can you handle 90 seconds? Okay. I'm gonna do with a 90 second question for all of you, which will be, because there are a lot of very specific questions in here, as you can imagine. So I wanna start with a kind of a general question. Clearly there is a challenge in the whole issue of balancing the city, the residential desires for using the parks against the financial resources available. What specifically would you push for as mayor to increase the resources for parks, financial resources, unless in fact you feel that it would be great to have more, but realistically there are a lot of other demands on the city general fund as well. So I'm going to, I think what I'll do is, just do this real straight and just 90 second answer in terms of what would you do to bring more resources to parks, and we'll just start with Phil Ting and march down the row.
Well, thanks, Sean. Revenue is something I know a little bit about in San Francisco. One thing is we can make government more efficient by making my office more efficient. I've helped bring in over $300 million over the last 6 years into the general fund and into our city budget. And that was by making outside reforms, by computerizing technology. So I think if we make sure that we invest in my office, our treasurer, tax collector's office, I think there's a lot more money to actually collect and making sure all the loopholes that are out there are being closed. We actually have a hotel internet loophole so that Orbitz doesn't pay the same tax as the Hyatt, even though you get in the same hotel room on that website. I think that should be closed. I've talked about closing the Prop 13 corporate loophole. Right now, I'm all for making sure no homeowner ever loses their home because of Prop 13. But I know that the Prop 13 protection that I have, or many homeowners have, should go to the Westfield Ball, should go to Bloomingdale, should go to Saks Fifth Avenue, should go to Macy's or AT&T Ballpark or the Transamerica Building. That money could be helping bring in over $7 billion of money to the state, a lot of which could go to parks and to our schools. I think also, like the supervisor talked about, Supervisor Alvarez talked about, I absolutely support a local vehicle license fee. I think that money should be targeted to transit, that money should be targeted to recreation, and many other things. I think our parks are so important. I spend most of my weekends actually in parks, given the age of my two children. And I visited most of them. I think one of the most important things I'm very proud to have supported was our parks bond from 2008, and making sure that's a reality. I'm also very excited to see my local park, the Sunset Rec Center, reopen after that park bond renovation.
Great, thanks so much. Tony Hall, resources for the parks.
Thank you, John. Phil says he knows a little bit about revenue. Well, I know a little bit about budgeting. I grew up in this city after 25 years of working with zero-based budgets. We haven't had that, folks, in this city since Art Agnos became mayor. Zero-based budgeting, you have to justify every dollar that every department spends every year from zero. No add-on COLAs, no add-on cost of living increases. San Francisco is a very blessed city. We have the highest per capita revenue to tax base of any city in the country. Our budget is 3 times higher now than it was 20 years ago with 800,000 people there. I ask you, are your parks any better? Are the streets any better? No. So what's going on here? Could it be our budgeting? Absolutely. As your mayor, the first thing I will do, and maybe there's some people out there that are not going to like to hear what I got to say, but I'm going to audit the devil out of the Rec and Park Department. That's exactly what I'm going to do. Because they are right now, in my eyes, one of the biggest abusers of city funds next to the PUC. There's a lot of money going astray there, folks. That's why I passed the Revenue Bond Oversight Committee in 2000, Proposition P, in 2002. That's been hijacked by the controller. Now, there are hundreds of millions of dollars going astray. And if people really care, you want to look into what I'm telling you, this is how you can correct and recoup and not charge people any more taxes or any parcel taxes or anything else. It's right here. We already have the money. So, sorry, I got to stop.
Thanks very much. Terry Joan Baum, Resources for the Parks.
You know, I really reject this question. How are we going to find the money? I want to ask, how did we get to the point of having to ask this question? And how can we change things so we don't have to ask this question? We live in a rich city, in the richest state, in the richest country in the world, and they have reduced our expectations so that we sit here, and it happens at every single forum, and say, how are we going to pay for the gardeners, and how are we going to sweep the streets and fill in the potholes? It is absolutely ridiculous. The money is being sucked upwards as I speak. The rich are becoming richer, and then the cities are asking, how are we going to fund keeping our gorgeous, incredible Golden Gate Park and all of our parks decent? The answer is that the money is at the top, and the way you bring it down is by taxing. And I say, tax the rich. Duh.
Great. Thanks a lot. And next up, John Analis.
Well, there's a number of ways to really find revenue for the Rec and Park Department. Yes, we do need to assure we have progressive taxation to bring in to shore up our budget all around. Generally, we have general fund money that comes in. We have to share it across all different departments. Last year, I put on the ballot an increase to the real estate transfer tax over the last fiscal year, and the current one is bringing in $45 million. That's going to help to balance the budget. But then we need to make sure we have good decisions across our budgets. In 2009, when I was chair of the budget committee, I actually fought to get money from two departments that are kind of sacred cows in the city and county of San Francisco. That's the police department and the fire department. At no expense to public safety, we're able to move millions and millions of dollars that was spread across other departments, including Rec and Park Department, to be able to shore up the budget to prevent further cuts and from fees from increasing. We need to make sure that we're providing greater general fund support for the Rec and Park Department. If not, we have to make a lot of Sophie's choices about raising fees. We cannot raise fees any longer on residents. We also have some boondoggles that are within the Rec and Park Department. Right now we have Shark Park, which is in Pacifica, that is a huge subsidy that we're providing for that not taking care of endangered species that are there. Over the past several years, from 2005 to the present, Shark Park has lost $1.2 million. And we have a lot of issues like that around the Rec and Park Department that we can actually support all the other greater uses we have for Rec and Park, for gardening, rec directors, for recreation, for creating open space and maintaining it. That would be much more beneficial than to shore up failing golf courses in the city.
Right. Thanks very much. And Shark Park is definitely one of the questions that was submitted. And next on the question, Jeff Adachi, Resources for the Parks.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with Terry more. And if I was running for President of the United States, I would say that we have to reform the IRS tax code. And Congress had the opportunity to do that. And did they do it? No, they dropped the ball. I got involved in a very unpopular issue a couple of years ago because I was asking myself the same question. In that year, the parks budget was cut by 50%. Many of you remember that. You remember what happened. You remember clubhouses being shuttered and rented out. You remember fees being charged to get into the parks. And remember all the rec directors losing their jobs. And that's when I got into this issue involving pension reform. I saw that our pension costs in the city had gone up from $175 million 4 years ago to $457 million this year. Within 4 years, according to the city controller, it's going to go up to $829 million. Every year it's going up by about $100 to $125 million. There's no way that we can keep up with those costs, even with flat revenues. And so I put several measures on the ballot through signatures, and one of those measures is on the ballot this year, it's Proposition D. And that measure will save the city $1.7 billion over the next 10 years, roughly between $80 and $200 million a year. That is money that can be reinvested in revitalizing our parks, our neighborhoods, our schools, and making sure that we're able to keep our city the great city that it is.
Thanks. And Mikel Aliotto here.
Thank you, John. I agree with zero-based budgeting, at least for the first year, so that we have an idea of where we stand. I also agree, not in a gotcha type of way, but I do agree in auditing Rec and Park, but I think we should be auditing all the different departments in San Francisco, and we should be looking at how we spend money everywhere. Right before I left, I had audited the three agencies that deal with childcare, First Five, DCYF, and Public Health, and we found that even though we had 150 families on the table for after-school program needs, we had $1 million in the bank that wasn't being spent because no one knew about it. So at some point, we need to make sure that we have streamlined the departments as much as we can, all of them, and that we're cutting waste. I agree with the bond. I also believe that we should be working more closely with our enterprise agencies. I sat on the Port Commission for 9 months before being elected to the Board of Supervisors or appointed to the board. And we did our own parks that were separate from the general fund and separate from the city's plan. And I believe that when you look at it, one of the big projects I hope to talk about later, in my opinion, should be the Francisco Reservoir. Keeping that as open space and getting the PUC to help us maintain it, but help us develop that into one of the most beautiful parks in San Francisco, which it can be. And when we have those opportunities, and when our enterprise agencies have those opportunities, then as a city, we should be working together to try and make them a reality.
Great. Thanks so much. Now, again, we have a number of very specific questions, about Golden Gate Park, but also Shark Park and the Francisco Reservoir. You folks are all plugged in on these things. So what I'm going to do is try and just 1 minute. I'm sorry all this is so complicated. We're trying to keep you on your toes. 1 minute answers, and I'll just do, two candidates at a time on this. So we will start with the question, as a candidate for mayor, do you support the largely privately funded $12 million plan to replace the grass playing fields at the beach chalet with 7 acres of artificial turf and tall night lighting? Or would you favor a more modest and less costly restoration of the fields with a natural grass surface, as was done recently at the polo fields? And I will address that to Jeff Adachi and to Phil Ting. So maybe Jeff first on that?
I mean, from what I've read, I would not favor the $12 million grass playing field. I think that there's serious questions as to what the environmental impact would be, and I understand there has been an environmental impact report that's been ordered, that's supported by Supervisor Eric Marr. And from what I read as well, there are significant health risks that have been identified relating to national turf. And, I've read some of the materials that have been provided by those who do favor that project, and, particularly the ecological merits, that is saving water. I think those are things that should be considered. But I do think that we should be very cautious in proceeding, and that we need to carefully study the EIR report before moving forward.
Great. Thanks so much. And Phil Tang.
Well, one thing I think we need to definitely do is see if we can find a new home for that wastewater treatment plant they're going to put next door. I think the environmental damage that's going to do versus the renovation is obviously much more significant. Now, having said that, I'm also, just echoing our public defender's viewpoint, also do have concerns about the environmental degradation. We want to make sure that we balance that with the needs of our children. You know, I know that we have a dearth of soccer fields and recreation areas. I know that that we don't have as many soccer fields as we need, and I know we don't have the hours, and we obviously don't have the money, as we just talked about in this last question. So for me, I would really want to make sure that we're bringing everyone together and balancing all those concerns. I would definitely want to make sure that we're doing everything in an environmentally responsible way. I don't think that it makes sense to deface a beautiful park, but again, you know, I would want to understand why we need turf. I would want to understand why we, what are the pros. My understanding is it's good to, we need more hours, we need more soccer fields, but again, I think we need to make sure that we have a balanced approach to all those.
Great, thanks a lot. Now, the next question, again, a Golden Gate Park type of question, and two new but very popular traditions in San Francisco are the Outside Lands Festival and the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival. The question, though, is, are they in the wrong place? And would it be good to move them from Golden Gate Park to Candlestick Park or McLaren Park to lessen the impact on the natural flora and fauna of Golden Gate Park? And this is a question to John Avalos and Michaela Alioto-Peer, and we'll start with Michaela Alioto-Peer.
Thank you, John. I don't think they should be moved. I like them in Golden Gate Park. I think that I like watching music in nature and pulling them out to Candlestick Park would just make it a very different experience. And I think that big events like that are exciting for our children, and I think they draw people into the park to look at other parts of the neighborhood and the park. But I will say that I do like the idea of McLaren. I think that McLaren is one of San Francisco's little jewels that has gotten very dusty and needs some polishing, and I think that trying to bring those festivals that do drive a lot of people and drive a lot of resources and drive a lot of money into McLaren Park could probably help McLaren tremendously. And they have a beautiful arena out there, and there's certainly the space for it. So I would not necessarily like to see it moved, but I think that we should be focusing on McLaren and getting those types of festivals out to McLaren.
Great. And John Avalos, a neighbor of McLaren Park.
That's right. Well, if there's anything I regret about being elected official, is that I don't have time to go to Outside Lands and Hardly Strictly Bluegrass. I have not been, I used to go all the time when I wasn't on the Board of Supervisors, and I haven't been since I've been on the Board of Supervisors. I think they're great events, and they bring a lot of revenue to the city, but also a good way to showcase our parks. Do I think that the Candlestick Park is a place where that should happen? I would say no. And McLaren Park, I don't think McLaren Park is quite big enough to actually have events like that. And I understand that there is a lot of temporary damage that happens in Golden Gate Park due to Outside Lands and these events, but they're also really good places for people to enjoy the parks and get accustomed and acquainted with the parks as well. And a lot of times we are bashing the Reagan Park Department, but I realize that the Reagan Park Department also does very little with a lot with a little. You look at parts of Golden Gate Park, there are really great parts that are pristine, and we need to make sure that we have the resources that can be devoted to shore up all the parts of Golden Gate Park and make it the world-class attraction that it truly is.
Great, thanks. And the last Golden Gate question, Golden Gate Park question, again, I'm 1 minute long, will be for Tony Hall and for Terry Joan Baum. And there are lots of big issues in Golden Gate Park, such as, we mentioned the playing fields, the water reservoir, there's also Stowe Lake and everything. Also a very small one, and that's the one for the both of you, which is, would you be willing to allow more diverse food trucks to sell food in Golden Gate Park and other city parks? And we'll start with Tony Hall.
That's a great question. Let me just refer back to two things first, John. As far as the artificial turf in Golden Gate Park, I think everybody here knows what's behind that. It's about lobbyists and people making money replacing natural ground with artificial ground. That's all that is. There's absolutely no reason in the world to have artificial turf in Golden Gate Park. And forget about the irrigation thing.
Yeah.
Number two, the Outsized Lands Festival and the Bluegrass Festival. I'm an ex-musician. The problem there, again, comes down to enforcement. The big problems with those two things happening is sound and enforcement of parking. You can correct those things. So they should stay there, McLaren. There's no other venue in town that's big enough to hold them. But to answer your question, more diverse food trucks. What do we allow? Just one type of food in there now?
Hot dogs and pretzels.
We can have the gourmet deli come running through. I mean, you know, whatever works, whatever the folks want, let's give it to them, you know. I mean, I'm not about restricting it in any one shape or form.
And Terry Joan Bond.
I can't stand the food trucks in the park because they're running their motors all the time. It is such a violation of being in nature. Forget it. I'm open to the possibility of a kiosk with tables and, you know, refreshments, but the food trucks with the gasoline fumes, no. I don't want them in, I can't stand them in anywhere in any of the parks. And I really do believe there are no chairs, there's no amenities. If we're going to have food, let's have at least a few little chairs and tables so people who have trouble sitting on the ground can have somewhere to sit. So no food trucks. And I just want to make the point that I just want to read from the master plan for Golden Gate Park in terms of all these issues of what happens on the western edge. And it says, the major design feature of Golden Gate Park and the framework within which all park activities occur is its pastoral and sylvan landscape. The integrity of the pastoral and sylvan landscape must be maintained and remain unaltered. So the concept of this rubber and toxic plastic field with these enormous banks of light on the western end. The eastern end is supposed to be for cultivation and art. The western end is supposed has been planned from the very beginning to give us the feeling of nature. I'm so grateful for whoever sent me this plan because I understand now why it's so special. Let's keep it that way.
Thanks. And we're running just a little behind, so I want to read a question. I'm not going to ask anyone to answer it. I just like the question because it's kind of an interesting thing that there is a certain... And the reason I'm asking is more just to kind of the challenge, again, short of redrawing basic financial systems in the country. I mean, there is this looking to private sources and all, but one of the questions that came from the audience, and then we're going to move on to forests, is many parks have means of generating revenue, such as clubhouses or concessions, but others are simply too small for any of the recent income-generating ideas from Recreation and Park Department. How will you address this funding inequity and assure that even the small parks in poor neighborhoods like the Tenderloin get their fair share? And I only mention that because I think that is a basic challenge of a mayor, which is there are the big hot-button issues that come before you at any time, but there are so many very small, very valued pieces of the city. So I now want to move on to the next topic, which, again, that's what it is with three sponsors. The next question is on forestry, and the sponsoring group, Friends of the Urban Forest, and I know I've got the question here, they exercised their prerogative as a sponsor to ask me to address a question to all of you. So that is what I will do, and it's kind of a general one, but it really does come down to a very basic question of trees in the city. And there will be two minutes for each of you. And here's the question. According to the Friends of the Urban Forest, former DPW Director Ed Ruskin has said that our trees are the only infrastructure investment that appreciates over time. Yet the dense development patterns of San Francisco mean we lag behind other cities in the percent of area actually covered by trees. Earlier this year, in response to cuts in Mayor Lee's proposed budget, DPW said it would transfer tree care responsibilities for 24,000 street trees from the city to the nearest property owners. After public complaints, the Board of Supervisors said it would look for ways to maintain the city's tree care responsibilities. The question, what viable long-term solution do you propose to protect and grow the city's green infrastructure generally and its urban forests specifically? In other words, how do you protect the trees we've got now and add more? And this question is for everyone, 2 minutes each. And we will start with, now I've got my order all mixed up. We will start with Phil Ting.
Great, I mean, I think the most important thing is, you know, we're in an environment in government where we do have to do less with more, and we do have to become more efficient. It's what we're asking everybody in the private sector to do. It's what everybody else has to do in their lives. And I think that we have to raise the bar on DPW. We have to raise the bar through every single city agency to make it more transparent, more accountable, to really ensure that you all and we all are holding every agency, every public service accountable to make sure they're doing the very best job possible. And I think much of that has to be put out into the open. I'm a huge fan of urban forestry, urban trees. I think it makes a huge difference. I live in the Sunset, where it's quite common where you do have many blocks where there are no trees, and you do have some blocks which there are many trees. And I think all you need to do is look at the contrast for how trees make a big difference between looking at 19th Avenue versus Sunset Boulevard, or looking at 19th Avenue as it turns into Park Presidio. And what's the difference? It's not that there are fewer cars or that there are fewer people going up and down. It's really the streetscape. It's the planning and what it really looks like. I think we need to make sure that we are adequately funding this. That's why we've been talking about reforming Prop 13. You know, I think we need to talk about reforming our tax policy. I think many of these issues, again, it's a question, are we gonna fund urban forestry by taking away from public health? Are we gonna take away from public schools? Are we taking away from public safety? I mean, I think those are really not the choices we wanna be making, or very responsible choices. I think we need to really be looking at what our revenue streams and making sure it's responsible. That's why I said we should be subsidizing, you know, large, huge property owners that are getting 30-year subsidies on property. We should be taking that money and funding parks, funding education, funding roads, and making sure that that is really a value statement for our society.
Okay, thanks. And the next person to, and I'll even let you catch your breath. Next question answers essentially, how do we maintain the trees that we have and add more? We'll go to John Avalos.
Well, I see that we need to be making sure that our budget is more or less whole, or we can expand our budget for our tree program in the Department of Public Works, and we have actually been cutting back over the years significantly. I don't recall how many staff we have. It's either 12 or 7 that we have for tree maintenance in San Francisco. That's down from probably about 30 that we had maybe at the peak around 2005. I think maintaining that program in DPW, but also combining it with organizations like the Friends of the Urban Forest that could help do a combination of work. There's great job programs that are part of Friends of the Urban Forest where a lot of young people are doing some of the tree maintenance. This is green jobs that we're actually, we can provide more green jobs in San Francisco by training young people to take care of trees. And to actually have some income coming in, but contributing greatly to our natural urban environment and our urban forest. I've seen really great expansion of trees in my district, in District 11, the Excelsior neighborhood. We have, in 2009, we planted about 98 trees in one day, probably about 65 trees the next year as well. This is having a dramatic impact on people's sense of neighborhood and volunteering. So I think having a combination of, you know, nonprofit jobs that can be provided and expanding what we do at DPW can help, you know, expand what we do for the urban forest and make sure that we can keep it healthy and thriving in years to come.
Great, thanks very much. And the next person to answer the questions about how do we take good care of the trees that we have and add more, Tony Hall.
Thank you, John. How do we do this? Like anything else that involves good government without no new taxes. I'm sorry, I'm just against any new taxes, revising Prop 13 or anything else. Again, as I said earlier, we're a blessed city. We have enough funds to take care of this. A dedicated annual appropriation is what is needed, where the funds cannot be diverted into other uses like what has been happening in the last 15 years. If the city plants the trees, I assume they got the brains enough to figure out how to take care of them. Okay? Now, if they don't, then they should be taken out of office. That's simple. We cannot any longer divert funds for what the public votes on to other uses and then turn around and ask the public to take care of it. It's not fair. So that's one of the things that I would do as a mayor. I'd have an honest budget, an honest dialogue with you about what you want, and make a promise to you every year in advance through zero-based budgeting, this is what you're going to get. Taking care of the trees that the city plants is just the city's responsibility. And to throw that back off on people, it's not fair. Volunteerism to make up for the deficit? Absolutely. I totally believe in it. Do I believe in parks? Absolutely. Do I believe in open space? Absolutely. And I will accomplish that in any way I can. But with your dollars, I'm going to try to appropriate that in the most honest, forthright way I can to make sure that you're getting served.
Thanks. And the next question, the question will now go to Supervisor David Chu, who had a prior engagement, as I mentioned, came in late. I've already told him who you are. So again, the question, how would we take care of the trees we have and add more trees?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry that I am late, and I want to thank all the sponsoring organizations for having us here today. I think to expand a little bit on this topic, in addition to what I agree with my colleagues, I think as a city, we also need to think about unused spaces and take advantage of them. I requested that the Rec and Park Department identify potential land in our possession that we could turn into additional community gardens. And I want to thank some of the folks here in this room that helped me to pass some of our country's cutting-edge legislation around urban agriculture. I think there are many spaces that we could use to really expand our urban forest into, whether these be, for example, alleyways right now in some of our densest neighborhoods, whether it be the spaces in between city blocks, behind buildings and in between buildings, and whether it be some of our underutilized vacant spaces that could be turned into urban gardens and urban forests. I think there are many places that if we look around the city, we could have the imagination and the vision to see them as urban forests, as places where new trees, new urban areas could be cultivated by folks here in this room in partnership with us at the city.
Great, thanks very much. Next, the question of taking care of the trees that we have and adding new ones to Terry Joan Baum.
Do more with less. How to make do. How about we rescind the $50 million tax break to Twitter and spend it on trees? What about that? I mean, right now we're saps, but that would buy a lot of saplings, wouldn't it? It's these questions of how are we going to make do are exactly what we have to rebel against. We have to really have a paradigm shift in our culture and take it back from the corporations so that we can do this. That being said, trees are special. Trees are plants with souls. And I feel that we need to really nurture the tree culture and the appreciation of trees in San Francisco. I think the children at school should be involved in planting and also caring for the trees around their different trees all over the city that have been nominated, and people going around and deciding which is the most beautiful tree in the city, because trees are, they really are this tremendous spiritual force in our landscape and on our streets, and I would really want to make that blossom even more.
Terrific, thanks. And next, Michaela Aliotto-Pierre.
Thank you, John. I think that this is actually
it's an issue that has always really frustrated me, because I think that we need a fundamental shift in the way that we view urban forestry in San Francisco. In my opinion, it's not the, or it shouldn't be the sole job of DPW. When you look at studies across the nation, when you have more trees, you have a decrease in violence, you have a decrease in crime. I represented the Seacliff area, and Seacliff, what most people don't know, the dirty little secret about Seacliff, is that in the, during the rainy season, they get raw sewage that goes down their streets. And what we have found is that by taking up some of the sidewalk space and building gardens and planting trees, we can help alleviate that. And so when you look at some of the other problems that some of our, again, enterprise agencies deal with and other departments in San Francisco, trees should be an integral part of everything that we do. If it's going to alleviate and help our sewer system, then the PUC should be investing in planting trees, and they should be maintaining them and taking care of them, because they save in the expense. If it actually decreases violence and decreases the rate of crime, then we should be more actively using the different departments that we have to build more trees in the areas that need them, throughout the Tenderloin, throughout the Western Addition, throughout the Bayview. You drive through areas like Sunnydale, and it is remarkable how housing establishments so close to McLaren Park can be so devoid of any life other than the people living in it. And we wonder why it's one of the most dangerous parts of town. And we look at the different types of investments that we make, and the truth of the matter is that although trees are really beautiful and pretty, they serve a very real function. And as a city, we should be taking advantage of the fact that they do have a positive impact on almost every major economic problem that the city has.
Great, thanks very much. And last of all, Jeff Adachi.
I promised Josefa, who runs the coffee shop on Monterey Boulevard, that if I had a chance to mention her story, I would. She's got a tree right in front of her business. It's a beautiful tree. She was told that she had responsibility for that tree because the city would no longer take care of that tree. Well, leaves fell from the tree, as they often do, and she took the leaves and picked them up, and she put them in the city receptacle garbage can. Guess what? She got a ticket. She got a ticket. She got a $40 ticket for putting the leaves in there. She complained. They refused to do anything about it. And so now, every time I go to her coffee shop, there's leaves everywhere. Why? Because she doesn't want to get another ticket. These are the kind of things about government that drive you crazy. And we often don't hear about it because people don't complain, or if they do complain, it never reaches us. And so if we're going to have a tree-first policy, we got to make sure that we walk the walk, not just talk the talk. And if we're talking about shared responsibility, I think that's fine. But the city has to make sure that it's doing its part. I would really like to see a model similar to what we're seeing in Chicago and New York, where they're bringing in trees in areas where there are none, where they're beautifying areas which were basically cement blocks. And my hope is that, you know, through fiscal accountability, and that's the only way we're going to get the resources that we need to fix the problems that we're talking about at this and other forums, that we're going to be able to achieve that in the next few years. Thank you.
Great, thanks. And what we're going to do now, it's about 20 minutes to 8, so we're going to move to the closing statement, so each candidate gets to wrap things up. And I want to thank everyone for taking part, and the two that came and went earlier, because I know how pressed all of your schedules are this time of the year. And I also want to apologize for all the good questions unused. That includes my own favorite question, which was adding mid-block crosswalks to the south of Market Grid. Since I work at Fifth and Mission, I thought, I got to ask that question. There it is, left aside. But anyway, so why don't we just, I'm going to kind of go at random here in terms of the closing statements. 2 minutes each. We've just got time for that, and we'll start with Tony Hall.
Thank you again, John. You know, folks, as a father of seven, and I raised all seven kids with my lovely wife, same wife, mother of seven, in a three-bedroom house, so the playgrounds were really our backyard. San Francisco houses are very small. We didn't have a backyard. We were fortunate enough to have three playgrounds in the close vicinity. And that's why when I ran for supervisor in District 7, my priority was Reckon Park. There's two sides to Reckon Park. There's the recreation, which we haven't talked much about tonight, and the park side. I happen to be in love with both sides. In District 7, I refurbished, if not all, part of 18 different parks. I was a killer on trying to make sure that the young kids, because District 7 has a lot, like District 11 and whatnot, have a place for recreation. Really important. I'm also one of these guys that kind of tries to put my money where my mouth is. When I was out at Treasure Island and the mayor asked me to give the contracts to political donors, I said no and was forced out of that job. Before I left, I built the greatest athletic fields in Northern California for rugby, Gaelic football, and baseball. I don't know how many of you have been over there. That's how important it is to me now. And those fields are going to stay there until they develop that island in the year 3500 or whatever it is. But more importantly, when I became a supervisor, Lake Merced was paramount. I made a promise to restore it and refurbish it. That took me 2 years, and it was a killer. So then, along with that, I did the Revenue Bond Oversight Committee because I knew. And can I take my extra minute here?
I think we can just squeeze it in.
Okay, great. I knew that we were going to be reaching a crisis with our city funding. And that's why, like Jeff, I'm very concerned about pension reform, except my program is totally different than his and totally different than the mayor's. I personally see the mayor's program as a union-dictated program. It's a 5% fix. I see Jeff's is about twice as good at a 10% fix. But I know that our $7 billion unfunded liability is going to become a $12 billion unfunded liability within 7 to 8 years. We're not going to have money for pensions. We're not going to have money for parks. We're not going to have money for anything. So what I'm proposing is a whole new program for all new city employees that defines contributions and allows 401ks, so the city isn't stuck for a lifetime of care after 5 years. That's the only way this problem is going to be solved. It's not going to be solved by Prop C or Prop D. It's a temporary fix. What I'm talking about is what other cities across the country are attempting to do to avoid hitting the bankruptcy wall. And I'm being very honest and very truthful with you. We can talk all night long about Reckon Park. We're not going to have the money to do anything if we don't address this problem, and we address it in a real way. This isn't a care not cash type of spin. This is real. So as your mayor, I want to make you proud, safe, and once again happy to say you live in San Francisco, because I want to return this city to its destiny as one of the greatest cities in the world. I need you to help me do that. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. David Chu, your closing statement.
Again, thank you for being here tonight. I'm sorry I wasn't here with you earlier. But let me first start off by saying that I moved to this great city 15 years ago because of all that is incredible about San Francisco. I am someone who was attracted to the city in part because of our diversity and our commitment to social justice, which is why I worked for a number of years as a civil rights attorney and as a criminal prosecutor. Like many folks here in the city, I'm also someone who is attracted to our city's innovation, which is why I helped to start a small technology company and ran that for 8 years. But like I think everyone in this room, I also moved to the city because of its beauty. And I should tell you that almost every Sunday until I was elected to the Board of Supervisors, I would try to find a park somewhere in the city to take a nap, to hang out with friends, and to otherwise read. And I am, like all of you, someone who is very concerned of where the direction is going on some of these fundamental assets for our city that we are in danger of seeing some of our greatest treasures not being taken care of. Our top priorities, from my perspective, for where we need to go, we need to reverse the trend of family flight, and that is not something that we are doing particularly well with at this time. We need to do a far better job of building a world-class transportation system here in San Francisco, and I want to thank the pedestrian advocates who are here. One of the biggest issues that I've been talking about in recent months on the campaign trail is the fact that in San Francisco we have 12 city departments that are supposed to be regulating safety on our streets. We have some of the most dangerous pedestrian intersections in the city, and we know where they are. And as a city, we're not coming together to really invest and moving ourselves forward as a 21st century city. I wish I had more time with you, but I would ask if you have a moment to visit my website at David Chu for Mayor. We have a 21st century blueprint for San Francisco with ideas on how we're going to move forward transit, how we're going to move forward a plan for families, and how we're going to take care of our open space. And I would ask you to hopefully join us and all of us in making sure that we are building a better San Francisco. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then the next statement will be John Avalos, but I forgot the thing that you folks are also political savvy, you know, which is you vote for three people, not one. And you count one, two, three. It's not an essay question. Okay, and now a closing statement from John Avalos.
I'm John Avalos, and I'm 47 years old. I want to acknowledge all the people who are passionate about parks in San Francisco. I can't think of any department that churns up so much support from regular folks, everyday folks all across San Francisco. I'm looking at Linda Lighthouser, Joe Lighthouser, who are passionate park advocates from District 11, Kathy Howard over here. We have an incredible amount of talent and interest from everyday folks in San Francisco, and that is energy and power that I believe Reckon Park has not been sufficiently wise enough how to utilize and to make sure that we can actually make our park something that works for everyone. I'm also passionate about parks, and I'm passionate about parks from a parent perspective. Just this day, my greatest joys right now as I'm running for mayor is walking my kids to school. And we go right down Russia Street and we turn right on Excelsior, and my daughter, instead of walking along the sidewalk, she'll run right through the park, the playground, and she'll run on the tire swing and take a few swings and run out to the sidewalk and meet me again. And we already have a young, new member of an upcoming generation who's going to be another park advocate in San Francisco. And I want to make sure that she believes in the parks, and the parks are going to be safe and something that she can utilize for years to come. But we don't think wisely about how we can support our parks with greater general fund support. That's something I've been looking at for years. I want to find revenue. We have a lot of wealth in this city, in the city and county of San Francisco. Obama came to San Francisco about 3 months ago. He came on a Monday and he left on a Wednesday, and he had about $13 million when he left the city. That's for his campaign. But we know we have about $500 million that we can tap from the wealthiest people in San Francisco that can go for muni, for parks, for public health, for our schools, that can make a huge difference in how we make a city that truly works for everyone. Let me extend my time a little bit. And we don't always make the best decisions about how we utilize our Reckon Park staff. I actually worked to try and prevent the Botanical Gardens from having a fee for non-residents. And the Reckon Park Department spent hundreds of hours to try and maintain a non-resident fee at the Botanical Gardens. I was bringing revenue. Last year we won revenue from the real estate transfer tax. We used a small part of that, $177,000, to be able to prevent having a non-resident fee. And the Reckon Park Department mobilized people who were lessees, who were contractors, who were union members, against keeping the non-resident fee from being eliminated. That is really unwise use of our Reckon Park facilities. It's also really unwise to turn aside what the will of the people is. And I think we need to have a much wiser way of utilizing our talents within the Reckon Park Department to embrace what's coming from the community in San Francisco. As your mayor, I'll be listening. I'll make sure we have a Reckon Park Commission that's going to be something you can expect is going to be listening to you and implementing your ideas for creating change in San Francisco. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And the next statement from Michaela Alioto Pier.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having us here today. I was thinking about my closing statement, and it reminded me when I was little. My dad had this drawer in our kitchen, and whenever we finished our bread, if we didn't eat the crust, we threw it into the drawer. And our Sunday morning ritual is that we would get up and we would go to Mass, and before we left for Mass, we'd go and we'd get the bread out of the drawer, we'd go to church, and then we would go to the marina, we would go to the Palace of Fine Arts, and we would feed the ducks. And we did that every Sunday. And then my great-grandmother lived across the street on Baker, and we would go over there, and she would make us pasta for lunch. And that was our day.
And I think of my children. I have 3, 10, 8, and 6. And I think of our days and what their memories are going to be as adults, like mine. And I know that as an adult right now, I spend my Saturdays and Sundays on the soccer fields. We go from one to another. And it is it's a wonderful way to see San Francisco. But it really gets you, you become a part of your environment. As a District 2 supervisor, there's one project that I want to mention that I mentioned earlier, and I say this to you because I want you to be thinking about it, which is the Francisco Street Reservoir. It is the largest undeveloped land in the country in a major urban area. And I want to be delicate in the way I say this, but the PUC believes they own it. I personally believe that we have a say in it. And I believe that that should be one of our new beautiful parks. It is one of the most beautiful areas overlooking the bay. It is near one of the densest populated communities, which is Chinatown and North Beach. Chinatown has very few parks in it right now, and it is a great location for more soccer fields, which we need to attract our children. And with more children in San Francisco, we get more resources for San Francisco. So I just want to say, for our parks and our schools. So I just want to say thank you very much for being here. If you get a chance, if you're driving down Bay Street, take a look up that hill, and you will be amazed at the size of the land and at the opportunity that I believe it affords San Francisco, an opportunity that we would not otherwise have. And the one other thing I want to say is that the PUC wants to build homes on it, which would be great. They would have the most beautiful views. It is one of these areas where the America's Cup, you would pay a lot of money if you had a home in there. And it should be open space, and it should be open space for all of San Francisco's children and all of San Francisco's people. So take a look. And again, thank you all very, very much for being here tonight.
Okay, thanks. And Terry Joan Baum.
First, I want to talk about ranked choice voting. The most important thing that ranked choice voting means is that, remember all those times when you came up to the election and you thought, wow, I really like that candidate, but she or he doesn't have a chance. I would be throwing away my vote. I've got to be realistic and vote for somebody who is really high in the polls. Those days are over with ranked choice voting. You have the freedom to vote your heart, your conscience, your true politics, your passion, for the candidate who excites you the most with your number one vote. And then two or three, give it to one of those lesser evil folks who's very high in the polls. But number one, vote your heart. San Francisco is not separate from the rest of the country, and all these revenue problems we've been talking about are a symptom of what is going on in our country, which is that the money is being moved from any kind of public welfare and public pleasure, such as parks, and it's being cut and cut and cut, and meanwhile, the rich and the corporations are getting richer. And this issue is not being resolved by the Republicans or the Democrats. The two-party system is broken. Everything is being pulled to the right by the actual third party that is functioning very much now. And we need a voice on the left. If you elected a green mayor, a mayor from the Green Party, that would have an incredible effect on the whole country. It would open up political dialogue on the left. It would clear the sinuses of the Democratic Party and realize that they can't take us all for granted. San Francisco has always been a leader, and it's time for San Francisco to do it again. The country needs us to do this. It's time for San Francisco to woman up and become the city that outsiders think we already are. Thank you.
And the next to last is Phil Ting.
Well, thanks all. Thanks again for hosting this great debate tonight. We live in San Francisco because San Francisco is a world-class city full of world-class people. But unfortunately, when they talk about city government, they don't always talk about it as being world-class. And that's why I started Reset San Francisco, because I believe that San Francisco works best when you all have more say. And I think that the issues that we talked about tonight are really at the crux of our vision of a city. In our recent San Francisco, we talked about this idea of civic return on investment. For all those of you who invest in things, you understand return on investment. From a government point of view, our bottom line is not about making money. Our bottom line is about making a better life for our citizens and for our city. And when we talk about safety and pedestrian safety, there is a civic return on investment. That if you actually have safer streets, those neighborhoods are probably much more attractive. It's very interesting to see, well, the streets that are seen as dangerous, their property values are lower than the ones that have safer streets. When you have parks, parks add huge amounts of value. If you look at New York City, the two wealthiest parts of New York City actually border the two parks, border the east side and the west side of Central Park. In San Francisco, if we really took care of Golden Gate Park and really invested in Golden Gate Park, don't you think the same thing would happen? That the Sunset and the Richmond wouldn't be seen as maybe the cheapest place to live, but maybe the more desirable place to live. And I think that so often what we forget is that these trade-offs, these sacrifices, actually make our city worse off. That saving a dollar here today is quite penny-wise and pound-foolish. And that for really looking at the trees and planting trees, I think about my neighborhood in the Sunset, and I think about why it's so important to make sure that we have urban greenery. Because just drive down a block that has trees in the Sunset versus walking down a block that doesn't. And the feeling and the attitude, and again, the value that you've added for your citizens and for that neighborhood have radically changed. So I would just encourage you all just to remember that it's not just the bottom line of money, but it's really about what we're getting for what we're putting out.
Great, thank you. And the closing statement will be from Jeff Adachi.
Thank you very much. I'm going to use my bonus minute to acknowledge a program I have tremendous respect for. Nature is healing. Whether you go to the ocean, you go to the park, you walk around your block, you go to your neighborhood park, we heal ourselves through nature. You know, one of the most impressive programs that I've seen is called the Garden Project. And this is a program at San Bruno County Jail where inmates are given the opportunity to grow. I just had the experience of my daughter getting a little plot for her to be able to grow vegetables. She's 11 years old, and she's out there every morning tilling the soil. Well, that's what they teach the inmates, and they teach them how to heal through growing plants and trees. And Catherine Sneed, the director of the program, and her daughter are here, and I want to thank them. Over 150 inmates participate in this program. And these are the kinds of programs that we have to make sure continue in our city. Why am I running? Because I'm a reformer. I am somebody who's got a track record of fighting the political machine in the city. When I ran for public defender, nobody gave me a chance. I ran against the Brown Burton machine, and I was elected. As public defender, I have worked to create a world-class office, but more importantly, I have stood up for the civil rights and social justice issues again and again and again. Whether it's official misconduct occurring at the California Youth Authority, whether it's police misconduct knocking down doors without search warrants caught on videotape. That's the kind of leader we need in the city. We need somebody who's not going to be afraid to take unpopular decisions. Look at what's happening to our parks. Look at what's happening to our parks budget. Look at the privatization. All of these things have been happening since 2007. If you want them to continue to happen the same way that they've been happening, then don't vote for me. Vote for somebody else. I'm going to be somebody who makes sure that when we make a promise, whether it's making sure that our parks are cared for, are safe, our streets are clean, we keep that promise. And that we make sure that we use the public resources wisely. I'm the only candidate that has worked 2 years to bring fiscal reform to San Francisco. Not a popular issue, but something that needs to be done. And I think the testament to that is the fact that we do have two measures on the ballot, Proposition C and Proposition D, both pension reform measures. I think Proposition D is better, but you have a choice of two measures on the ballot. That's the kind of change we need in San Francisco. That's what I will bring if I'm mayor, and I'm here to ask for your support. Thank you very much.
Okay, and I want to hold your applause for half a second before everyone runs off. First of all, I want to thank the sponsors tonight, the Neighborhood Parks Council, Walk San Francisco, San Francisco Parks Trust and Friends of the Urban Forest. I also want to encourage, what is the website where all the questions are? Okay, sfpc.org, Mayoral Forum 2011. So while the candidates are running around town, they can have their little smartphones scanning the questions that weren't asked. And last of all, thanks to all of you for being here, and good luck.